photos of people.
Since the Arab Spring swept Syria in 2011, tens of thousands of people have disappeared in President Assad's secret prisons.
A woman sighs. My son has been taken. He's lost. I don't know if he's dead or alive.
Thousands have died inside. The brutality continues today.
These are torture chambers, full stop.
Prisoners have smuggled news to their families, written in their own blood. Survivors have come out with stories of the horror they witnessed. Now they're fighting to free those still detained and to prosecute the perpetrators.
A man says, "I will not rest until I take them to court and get justice." Tears roll down his cheeks. Syria's disappeared. The case against Assad. A man in a white shirt walks along a dimly lit corridor with many doorways off it.
I'm a career servant in the field of international criminal justice. I worked at the Yugoslavia Tribunal, Rwanda Tribunal. I was the first investigator at the International Criminal Court. This will be the final act in my career.
He unlocks a door and turns on a light.
Bill Wiley and his team of war crimes investigators have been smuggling material out of Syria to a secret location in Europe.
We've extracted about 600,000 pages of regime documentation.
A pile of books.
A wealth of potential evidence abandoned by the Syrian regime that could help build the case for a criminal prosecution.
The king or queen, if you will, of evidence in any international criminal investigation is always documentation. It isn't really easily cross-examined because it's factual, it's truth.
In the cache of papers, investigators found thousands of internal communications relating to mass arrests. With tens of thousands of Syrians disappeared in detention since 2011 and allegations of abuse, Bill's team wanted to find out whether the arrests were part of a systematic policy.
We're trying to lay the foundations for a prosecution along the Nuremberg lines where the prosecutors can lead with heavy, heavy, irrefutable documentary material.
Stephen Rapp has prosecuted some of the worst mass atrocity crimes in recent history. He's working with Bill Wiley on the case.
It was said in Nuremberg that the Nazis were, largely convicted on their own documentary evidence.
You have a
country that's like the Germans, in a way, document mad. They document things that even implicate themselves.
We didn't set out to build a case against President Assad or any other individual. We went where the documents took us.
The paper trail first led the investigators to the protests that began in Syria in 2011 and to the fate of those who took to the streets.
A bird's eye view of sunlight shimmering on a river as cyclists pass over a narrow bridge. A smartly dressed man's riding through woodland on a bicycle. He says, "My name is Mazen Al-Hamada from Deir ez-Zor, Syria. I worked for a French company. I lived with my family. You can't imagine how great our family life was."
Mazen came from a left-wing, middle-class family who had been targeted by the Syrian regime for decades for wanting democratic change.
Flags and a statue.
They opposed the authoritarian rule of the Assad family, who had governed Syria with a repressive military and security apparatus for over 40 years.
Protesters chanting, "Peaceful, peaceful."
Then in 2011, the Arab Spring swept across Syria.
Marchers on a city street. A man smiles. When you'd hear the demonstrations, your heart would fly. Unbelievable. Could this be happening, man? No one could believe it. I swear, no one could believe it. Everyone was happy. People started thinking up ideas and using their brains. Before this, that wasn't the case. It was forbidden.
Mariam Halak, a head teacher from Damascus, was a supporter of the regime and a member of President Assad's ruling Ba'ath Party. But her youngest son, Ayham, a dentistry graduate, joined the protests.
He was a good young man, she laughs. We had a really special relationship. He brought a lot of joy to our home.
Although Mariam opposed the demonstrations at first, she was won over by her son's enthusiasm.
He used to come back a different person. His eyes would be twinkling, his face glowing like this. The joy he felt, particularly when they used to do these dances. Footage shows people dancing in circles and jumping up and down, their arms linked together in a packed street. I felt an amount of freedom. We wanted a civil state and freedom, and that's it. To elect, we want free elections.
From the outset, President Assad's forces responded by shooting protesters, killing scores of people. The regime's violent repression just brought more protesters to the streets.
A huge crowd chants, "The people want the fall of the regime."
As the regime looked like it was losing control, it issued an order to arrest people on an unprecedented scale.
From a demonstration to files of paperwork.
War crimes investigators have pieced together what happened behind the scenes. Among the 600,000 pages of smuggled Syrian intelligence documents, they discovered this.
This is the key document which sets out the policy of the regime after several months of protests. It sets out the categories of persons to be detained for interrogation. So, in particular, financiers of demonstrations, persons who instigate demonstrations, and persons who communicate with foreign media or international organizations.
The order was from the top of the Syrian regime, from a body akin to a war cabinet, established to deal with the protests. The investigators have thousands of documents showing it was passed all the way down the chain of command.
The regime was hammering peaceful protesters.
The security forces made mass arrests, and the regime created more detention facilities to cope with the influx of detainees. Hospitals became part of this system. One of them was Tishreen Military Hospital in Damascus.
The location on a map.
Mohammed Al-Hamoud worked at the hospital for the regime. He's a defector. He headed an emergency department and was there when some of the first protesters were brought in by the security forces.
They threw them down in a brutal way, horrifying and utterly indescribable. At night, it was from the top of the bus or the top of the car. A person would be thrown onto the ground, whether it was a corpse or a wounded person. The torture was continuous from the entrance, from the ambulance door, from the car. They were being thrown on the ground. The wounded person would be tortured, or the corpse would be tortured. An old man was beaten with the back of a rifle to force him to confess. He said, "I don't know what the protest was about. I just came to look for my son, and you arrested me." They tortured him, broke his ribs, his lungs congested. He died on the first day.
Over 200,000 people were arrested in a matter of months. Mariam's son, Ayham, started working for a Syrian human rights group documenting the disappearances.
The first time I met Ayham, I was in my office. He was coming to me joking, and he was like smiling. He has like a special smile. I thought he was funny, and he was very nice.
Mansour al-Omari and Ayham had only been working at the Human Rights Organization for a month when their offices were raided by the security forces.
Soldiers were coming in like they were in a battlefield. They were carrying rifles, pointing at us their rifles. We were all shocked.
My son Ghassan came over and said, they took all 13 of them from the center, 8 men and 5 women. Who? Air Force Intelligence. These words alone, Air Force Intelligence, were terrifying. Damascus.
The Air Force Intelligence Branch at Mezeh Military Airport in Damascus, where Ayham Mansour and their colleagues were taken, is the site of one of the most notorious detention facilities in Syria.
Some of us were, like, destroyed. We were, of course, scared, and Ayham was different, really. He was, like, smiling, trying to make us smile. He sang, he wanted us to sing with him all the time.
After a month, Mansour and Ayham were moved to another detention facility.
Because Ayham is a doctor, they were beating him more. It was like that. They used to come, the soldiers used to come down and ask, where is the doctor? That's what they say. So each time he came in, he had 2 or 3 open wounds. And the other, the rest of his body is red or blue. He changed. He was silent all the time. Maybe because of that, of the beating he was getting, because he suffered so much. I don't know how he handled it.
A man sitting with a laptop.
Meanwhile, Mazin too had come to the attention of the security forces for organizing protests in his hometown. He fled to Damascus to evade capture. Investigators have thousands of arrest lists of who was wanted by the regime. We asked them to search for Mazin's name in the documents.
Okay, so we've got a hit here. It's Mazin al-Hamada. What's been logged here is a note dated January 2012, indicating that a certain Mazin al-Hamada, and indeed certain of his associates, should be picked up or detained if they come across him. What effectively they're saying is, we're looking for him, and if you come across him, arrest him.
In March 2012, Mazin was in a cafe with his nephews after they'd helped supply baby formula to a besieged area.
We were drinking tea and joking with each other, he explains. Suddenly, we were raided by the security forces. They put our shirts over our heads and put me in the trunk of the car until we arrived somewhere. I asked, where am I? And they said, you're in the Mezeh airport at the Air Force Intelligence Branch.
Mazin, like Ayham and Mansour, had joined the tens of thousands of Syrians disappearing in the regime's clandestine detention facilities.
They called my name for interrogation. He blindfolded and handcuffed me and took me to a room and made me kneel on my knees with my hands like this. He clasped them behind his head. Your name? I told him, Mazin al-Hamada. What have you done? I told him I went on demonstrations and such, videos, broadcasting news and such. As he makes a tutting sound, Mazin nods his head slowly. And he did this, he explains. He said, you need to confess to something else. I told him I hadn't done anything. He said, what type of weapon did you have? I told him, a camera, impertinently. I told him, a Toshiba camera, and I didn't carry arms, and I hate weapons. And he told me, I don't want these confessions. Take him. They took me, and they laid me on the ground and broke my ribs. And he said, it seems that you don't want to confess. You will confess. If you don't confess, we will kill you. I told him, that's all I have. The second time he brought me, he hung me. A handcuff from here and a handcuff from here. He indicates his wrists. By a window like this, 40 centimeters off the ground. After he hung me and took me back to the interrogator, he said, you'll see how we'll force you to confess. They brought a clamp. In English, it's called a clamp. And it has a handle that he put around the penis. Of course, after stripping you of your underwear, and you remain naked as God created you. And he put the clamp and started tightening and tightening and tightening. Squeezing until you feel like he's going to cut off your penis. And a man from behind puts a pole up your anus and is hitting you like this. Things that can't be imagined. The human brain can't imagine it. Many people died under torture.
Mazin was forced to give a false confession under torture.
And how do you feel about the people who did that to you?
Mazin blinks, his eyes shining, as he appears to be searching for the words. His face etched with anguish, Mazin gulps, then a solitary tear begins to trickle down his cheek. God will hold them to account. The law will hold them to account. I will not rest until I take them to court and get justice. Justice for me and my friends who they killed. Even if it costs me my life, I will pursue them and bring them to justice no matter what.
In a secret location in Europe, Bill Wiley's investigators are building a criminal case against the Syrian regime, using their cache of smuggled intelligence documents. They have interviewed hundreds of people whose names appear on the regime's arrest lists and interrogation notes.
The treatment of detainees in different parts of the country did not differ in any substantive way. Too many people have been physically abused. Too many people have been psychologically abused. Too many people have died in detention of unnatural causes to say that there's anything else but a widespread and indeed systematic practice of abuse.
Witnesses say the abuses weren't confined to the detention centers. Even when they were sent to hospital for treatment, the torture continued. Mazin says he was so severely beaten in detention, he was urinating blood. He was taken to a military hospital close to the detention facility, Hospital 601.
They said, forget that your name is Mazin Al-Hamada. I asked them, what's my name? And he said, your name is 1858. He said, I'll repeat, what's your name? I told him, 1858. He said, forget Mazin Al-Hamada. This is your new name. You reach the hospital, you go into the bathroom, and you find three dead bodies on the floor, stacked on top of one another. What's this? What? You close the door and open the other bathroom and find another two bodies. God, where am I? You start talking to yourself. Where am I? You feel like you're going crazy. After 5 days, they took me back to Air Force Intelligence. I went to the same room I was in. I told them, if anyone tells you to go to the hospital, don't go. The hospital means extermination. He gestures as if dusting off his hands. Hospital 601 is really a slaughterhouse, not a hospital.
Hospital 601 is less than a kilometer from President Assad's palace. Detainees were also taken to Tishrin Military Hospital, where Mohammed worked for the regime.
A sergeant major used to cover the injured prisoners with a white sheet. When it covered their faces, he would say to them, "You are a martyr, number such and such," a message to them that you will all be executed. So one of them lifted up the sheet and cried. He asked me, "Are they going to execute us today?" I said, "Only God knows. I have nothing to do with this. My job is not their job. I'm not a policeman." So he said, "Please swear on your life." I won't ever forget this sentence which this prisoner said to me. "If they execute us in this place, write about us that these people were in Tishrin Military Hospital, in a hospital, and they gave their souls as sacrifices on Syria's path to freedom from the fascist Assad regime."
Hospitals are implicated in the regime's own documentation. War crimes investigators found this memo from the judicial police in one province to the head of the criminal security branch there, complaining of a problem.
Quote, "Parents and relatives of the arrested persons are daily asking about the fate of sons, fathers, and brothers. You ought to listen to what they have to say. The hospital refrigerator is full of unidentified corpses that have disintegrated since they have been there for a long period of time. And what's particularly interesting in this case is that this individual has copied the Minister of Justice. So this localized problem is being brought to the attention of Damascus."
The top of the regime was being notified of the criminal nature of their detention policy.
Pictures of the disappeared, floating in darkness.
The Syrian regime know who they have detained and what has happened to them, but they refuse to give families any information. There are tens of thousands of people still missing in detention, including over 2,000 children. Sometimes prisoners are released. Mariam's son, Aham, was freed after 3 months, but Mansour was still locked up. He and his cellmates had no contact with the outside world.
I talk to them. I say to them, "I want to tell you something that's important, but we need to keep it secret." They said, "Okay." And then I told them, "We have like 57 people here, and we need to write all their names with details as much as possible. So when someone of us go out, can take those names with them." So we started like looking for the tools.
They tore off pieces of their shirts, found a fragment of chicken bone to write with, and used rust and their own blood as ink.
And we started collecting names and writing them every day, all the names of the detainees. We were worried that somebody could leak this news to the jailers. It's like leaking military information to the enemy, because the names of detainees in a military place is secret information. You could be hanged for it if they knew about it.
Meanwhile, Mariam's son Aham was back at university doing his master's in dentistry. It was there, 6 months after his release, that he was seized and beaten by members of the students' union aligned to the regime. They handed him over to military intelligence and he was taken to Detention Facility 215.
I felt as if I'd been struck by lightning. I went to see the Attorney General and I explained to him directly, my son has been taken and he's lost. I don't know if he's dead or alive or anything. He said, submit a request. So we submitted a request and nothing happened.
Mariam did not give up. Risking arrest herself, she continued to pursue the regime for any information about her missing son. In detention, Mansour had secretly documented the names of his fellow detainees on scraps of material. Information that their families on the outside were desperate for. The cellmates now needed a plan to smuggle the pieces out.
One of us, he was a tailor, and he said, I can do it. I can put it inside the hem of the shirt and inside the collars, and it will not appear, so nobody will suspect it. We pledged to each other that the first one who will be out will wear it and take it out with him. My name was called. It was me.
Mansour got the names out.
He holds a fragment of the shirt.
When I look at those shirt pieces, written with blood, blood of people who are still there, some of them I knew, I got news, they are dead. I have their blood with me. I have the handwriting of a man. These shirts are, I feel it's filled with souls, with their souls. I called many families, and the families need to know, at least, they have the right to know if their sons are dead or alive.
Mariam was still searching for Aham 18 months after he disappeared in detention. She was constantly requesting information about him from the military police.
They didn't tell me anything until an assistant felt sorry for me because I visited him so often.
The assistant gave Mariam this note.
The word corpse 320 immediately drew my attention. I screamed, he's a corpse now, and it has a number. The situation became real. Now there was no hope.
The note says that Aham, corpse 320, died on the 11th of November 2012, which was only 6 days after he was detained. All this time, the regime had records about his death, but had refused to tell Mariam. Like other families of detainees, she was finally given a death certificate, stating that her son had simply died of a heart attack in a hospital. She refused to believe that version of events and was determined to find out the truth.
What I was aiming for was to prove that he had died at a security branch. I pursued it a lot on a daily basis. Every day until they got bored of me, all of them. But I was able to get what I most wanted, to get that. She reads from a form. The named Ayam Ghazul died when he was detained by one of the security branches. A photo of Mariam with her son.
Mariam believed she now had proof that her son had died in regime detention. As thousands of Syrians continued to disappear in the network of detention facilities across the country, the regime continued to deny the allegations of torture that abounded. But then came a defector, here in the blue hood. His identity hidden, he was codenamed Caesar. He claimed to be a member of the Syrian military police, working as a forensics photographer at Tishreen Military Hospital and Hospital 601. He escaped from Syria with thousands of photographs. For Stephen Rapp, then U.S. Ambassador for Global Criminal Justice in the Obama administration, the photographs were a breakthrough.
When I finally gained access to the images, which I did in April of 2014, and sat in the computer and went through them, you know, one after the other, it's like pictures of hell.
Graphic images show naked, emaciated bodies with injuries from torture.
The most excruciating, sort of painful things that you can imagine. Examples with eyes gouged. Then you also see pain on the face, you know, kind of the frozen images of the last moments of life.
Some of the corpses are of boys. There are thousands of bodies in the photographs. This picture was taken in the garage of Military Hospital 601.
But of course, the first thing is the shock that the regime itself is taking these photographs. They were actually numbering, indexing, photographing, building files on the people that they tortured to death in total violation of international law, of their own laws, and we're keeping meticulous records of it.
Stephen met the defector, Caesar, now in hiding.
One of the first questions I asked Caesar is, you know, why would they do this? They want a record of the death. They have to do a death certificate. I mean, what's the reason here? And he said, well, those are part of it. But part of it is the regime is so bureaucratic that it's stupid. You know, that everybody has to follow these sort of standard procedures. And that's what they were doing in this particular case. And in the process of doing it, creating extremely powerful evidence against themselves.
These are images from two of the files that Caesar and his team of forensic photographers created. The text confirms that the photographs are of detainees, that they were held at Detention Facility 215, and that the bodies were photographed at Hospital 601 according to standard procedures.
When someone dies in prison, what do you do? You send the body to the Investigation Bureau. Evidence would have been gathered from the corpse. It'd be possible then to dispose of the corpse in a legal fashion. But it would be going through this sort of play act.
For Stephen, the evidence against the Syrian regime for mass atrocity crimes is some of the strongest he has ever seen.
Well, you've got facilities that are part of the regime under the control of the president. So they can't say, oh, it's a bunch of crazy thugs that were doing it, and we were against that. We wanted people to treat humanely, but, you know, sometimes boys will be boys, and I guess we just didn't know. Well, now they know, and they're not doing anything about it, not punishing a single soul. So you then have a case under international law of so-called command responsibility that makes commanders responsible if they know, and they don't do anything. You don't even have to prove they gave an order. It's enough. So this makes this, the legal equivalent of a slam dunk.
Photographed faces of the dead.
Families trawl through these headshots from the Caesar photographs, looking for their loved ones. There are over 6,700 corpses of people who died in regime custody. Among the photographs is corpse 320, belonging to Detention Facility 215.
I looked at it, and I knew it was him. It was him, it was his eyes, his everything.
A photo of Iham smiling beside another of his numbered corpse. Mariam says, when I saw the photograph, I felt a great relief. Now I carry it with me on my mobile, because it's a confirmation, because it's his last moments, because... because we didn't see his body. Mariam looks down for a moment in dignified silence, then takes a deep breath and exhales. So now we sometimes do workshops about transitional justice, and they ask, what would you ask for if things change? I say, I want a grave for my son. Holland. Mazen says, this is the flag of the revolution, which we wear like this. He puts it on like a cloak. We'll walk tomorrow at the demonstration like this.
Mazen is going to Geneva to demonstrate outside the United Nations and call for the release of Syria's disappeared detainees. He's printed out their photos to take with him. In some cases, entire families have been imprisoned.
This doctor was a Syrian chess champion. This is her husband and children. They're all in prison.
Mazen was released after 18 months in detention, but he has several close family members still missing in President Assad's prisons. He doesn't know if they're dead or alive.
Nighttime. He boards a bus.
It's 5 years to the day that protests began in Syria. Mazen's fellow travelers to Geneva took part in those demonstrations. And they're still singing the songs of the Syrian revolution. Like Mazen, many of them were detained and tortured. Some have had their homes destroyed. All of them have friends or family who've been disappeared by the regime. They're determined to get their loved ones freed.
They sing, smile, and give the victory sign. Mazen says, we're going to deliver this message today in front of the United Nations that young people, women and children, are being detained in Bashar al-Assad's detention centers. The detainees must be released now. With flag-holding demonstrators beside him, Mazen lays out photographs of the disappeared outside a United Nations building.
Tens of thousands of people are currently disappeared in regime detention. The UN has accused the Syrian government of the murder, rape, torture, and extermination of detainees, all crimes against humanity. But a Security Council resolution to refer Syria to the International Criminal Court was vetoed by Russia and China. Much of the international focus has been on the crimes of ISIS and other Islamist groups that the Assad regime are fighting in Syria. They have also imprisoned civilians, though on a much smaller scale. Mazen is campaigning to release those detainees too.
Mazen stands beside the images of the prisoners. We're telling people from other countries what these people's stories are. What have they done?
People are still being arrested by the Syrian regime. Despite the campaigning, little is being done to save the detainees.
Hundreds of thousands of people that have fled.
Stephen Rapp has left his job as an ambassador with the Obama administration and is campaigning.
And the cry from Syria is for justice.
He's trying to bring public attention to the victims in the Caesar photographs in exhibitions around the world.
And I want to thank you for being here tonight, to bearing witness to these crimes and stating your solidarity with these victims.
Stephen is frustrated by the failure of the UN to act on the overwhelming evidence of the culpability of the Syrian regime.
We're talking about the security services here. We're talking about state security. We're talking about military security. We're talking about Air Force intelligence within the chain of command, official forces. This is Syria. This is a the clearest case that I've ever seen. This is abundant evidence. Now, we've got more, so much more than we need. it's embarrassing in a way, and it particularly is embarrassing that we've got no court to take it to.
But there is one route to justice, and Stephen is pursuing it. Hundreds of Syrian families have identified their loved ones from the Caesar photographs. If just one of the thousands of victims was found to be a European national, or one of the perpetrators of these crimes was found on European soil, that would present a way of opening a case against the Syrian regime in a European court.
How's your health and everything? You feeling okay?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Mazen is helping Stephen with the case. He's trying to identify regime perpetrators who have slipped into Europe.
He very much wants to be a public witness, and that frankly puts him greatly at risk. And it's sort of like, after you've done all of this to us, to me, what more can you really do? I remember a woman whose children had been killed and who came to speak to me in another conflict zone. And then later that day, they were visited by security forces who threatened them. And they said, just go ahead and kill us. Just kill us. You know, if we can't tell a story, then we might as well die. And so there is that point that witnesses reach, which makes it hard for any of us to discount the truth that they're telling.
Mariam says, from the beginning, I made a decision that Aham's story must be told. Not because it's Aham, but because we are able to tell his story, because there are hundreds and thousands like him. I want Bashar al-Assad and all heads of the security branches to be prosecuted, a court case. A photo shows the family smiling on a beach. Aham was the secret of our happiness, she says. Sometimes I remember the nice things, but mostly it's the torture. And more, that he has turned into bones. Some days like this, some days like that. A home video shows Aham at work on his dental course.
Like most of the families whose loved ones have died in detention, Mariam still has no idea what's happened to her son's body.
If he is buried in mass graves in the Najjar area, there is hope that Bashar al-Assad will be prosecuted in the future and that we can find his DNA. But if it's true they are mincing the bodies, then it's very difficult.
President Assad denies any wrongdoing. When confronted with the Caesar photographs, this was his response.
Who verified the pictures? Who they verified that they're not edited and photoshopped and so on? It's just propaganda, it's just fake news. They want to demonize the Syrian government. In every war, you can have any individual crime. It happened all over the world, anywhere, but it's not a policy.
In one prison alone, said Naya, Amnesty International estimates that up to 13,000 people were executed between 2011 and 2015 in mass hangings that it says were authorized by the highest levels of government.
Do you know what goes on in that prison? Have you been there?
No, I haven't been. I've been in the presidential palace, not in the prison.
When asked about the allegations in our film, President Assad did not respond.
As usual, Mariam nods, as usual. He always does that. He denies everything. He lives in his own reality. Footage of a meeting on the 1st of February, 2017.
There has been a major development. The sister of one of the victims in the Caesar photographs is a dual Syrian-Spanish national and is filing a case against the Syrian regime for the torture and murder of her brother, claiming that she is a victim of the crime. Almudena Bernabeu, a renowned international human rights lawyer, is taking the case. She and Stephen are filing it today in Spain's National Court in Madrid. The charge is state terrorism.
When a state itself used those institutions to terrorize their own people, basically to send a message, if you dare rise up, if you dare demand your God-given rights, you're going to be tortured and murdered.
Stephen and the legal team are naming 9 individuals in the complaint, including the leaders of Syria's intelligence and security services, part of President Assad's inner circle. The focus will now turn to getting arrest warrants to apprehend the alleged perpetrators if they leave Syria.
This is the beginning of justice for those victims.
By candlelight, Mansour is examining the names written in blood on a fragment of cloth.
While a court case may bring justice for the dead, the urgent need is to free those still inside.
We need those who are detained to be free. People are still detained. Most of them are underground. We all know this. We have evidence. We have proof about that. Why are we doing nothing about them?
Okay, last question. I want to direct a final message. I firstly want to direct a message to all those who will watch this film. What I've said is a true story that happened to me. It's not a production of imagination, a true story. And my family is currently disappeared at the hands of Bashar al-Assad. Every person who sees the film or watches it, I appeal to the entire international community, to all humanitarians, to all who believe in humanity. Save the detainees. Protesters hold up photographs and names of the disappeared as flags of the Syrian revolution flutter in the breeze. In Paris, Mazen is one of many marchers walking along a city street inside the bars of a symbolic prison. A protester stands on a statue, waving the revolutionary flag under the French word liberté, which is carved in stone. Marchers chant.
Asha, Yurid, Esfah, Bandizam! Asha, Yurid, Esfah, Bandizam!